Welcome to the May 2015 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The American Academy of Dermatology designates this enduring material for a maximum of 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. Participation in this activity is completed by listening to dialogues on CD or a downloaded MP3 file, achievement of a 70% or higher score on the post-test, and completion of an activity evaluation. The date of original release for this issue is May 2015. The expiration date is April 2018. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to identify recent advances in standards of care in the diagnosis and management of melanoma, cite FDA recommendations on sunscreens, and identify the subtypes of HPV that are associated with an increased risk of squamous cell carcinoma. Contributors to this issue of Dialogues in Dermatology have disclosed the following financial relationships. Dr. Linda Calls is a stockholder and received no compensation from Gilead Sciences, Inc., Novartis, Regeneron, and her spouse has received grants and research funding from Genentech, Inc. Dr. Sandy Leachman has served on the advisory board for and received honoraria and has been a consultant for and received fees from Myriad Genetics, Inc. Dr. Henry Lim has been the principal investigator for and received grants and research funding from Clinuvel, Estee Lauder, and Ferndale Laboratories, Inc. He has served on the advisory board of and received honoraria from Ferndale Laboratories, Inc., and has been a consultant for and received honoraria from Johnson & Johnson Consumer Products Company, Laboratoire Dermatologique de Uriage, and Sanofi U.S. Services. Dr. Sarah Aaron has been the principal investigator for and received salary from Allergan, Inc., Anacor Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Eli Lilly & Company, Genentech, Inc., Kythera, and has served on the advisory board of and received honoraria from Roche Laboratories. All other contributors, including editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff, reported they have no relevant relationships with commercial interests. A comprehensive list of disclosed financial relationships is available in the syllabus.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for May 2015, Volume 71, Issue Number 5. I hope you're having another wonderful month. I keep reminding you about the fabulous new Dialogues in Dermatology app for your smartphone and computer. This convenient app is making Dialogues even more accessible and enjoyable while effectively providing CMEs for you. In this month's edition, in order to celebrate Skin Cancer Detection and Prevention Month, we have three timely dialogues including updates on melanoma and sunscreens, as well as focusing on the link between HPV and squamous cell carcinomas. One of the important services dermatologists provide is in the diagnosis and treatment of cancer, of which melanoma is one of the deadliest. With the discoveries of new therapies for melanoma, it is important for dermatologists to excel in their leadership roles as the experts who coordinate the intricate interdisciplinary care of patients with melanoma. In this dialogue, Dr. Sansi Leachman and Dr. Linda S. Calls give us a timely update on melanoma.
Hello, this is Linda Calls, and I have the pleasure of being with Sansi Leachman, who's the Chair of Dermatology at Oregon Health Sciences University, and also the Director of the Knight Melanoma Program. She has studied melanoma and melanoma genetics. She's here to update us on how we care for our patients with melanoma. And I think we can just start by saying that right now we've seen a lot of recent therapeutics that have become available, and that this is a really exciting time in the treatment of melanoma. Can you sort of give us an update of where we are and what we need to know?
Sure. It is. It's probably one of the most exciting times in the field of melanoma ever. And that's because for the first time, we have some drugs that are actually working. And that is great. And they're targeted. So it means that we have the opportunity to identify patients that are going to respond better or worse than others. And for the first time, be able to offer something downstream rather than just a sort of an interferon or something like that that's had questionable efficacy.
How do we, as dermatologists who may not necessarily be prescribing these medications, what do we need to know and what do we need to offer to our patients with this? How do we communicate with them, and how do we incorporate them into the bigger community?
Well, I think one of the key points there is that in such a rapidly advancing field where there's a lot of sort of specialized oncology and specialized surgical oncology that is happening really outside of the realm of the everyday practice of dermatology, it's important to know how to play a team sport, right? So you want to be able to engage with the people that have the area of expertise that's the most indicated for your patient at the time that they need it. And so from my perspective, I think the role of the dermatologist, we see the vast majority of melanomas that come in the door. We are in a way the gatekeepers of the majority of melanomas. And that also puts onto our shoulders the responsibility of knowing how they should be treated and where we should refer them so that they get the best state-of-the-art care. So I think that in a way, what we become are people who are advocates for our patients, patients that are going to need some help along the way, and we can know all those processes. So that means that we have the obligation to educate ourselves on what the guidelines for care are so that we know who gets referred to whom all the way down the line. And we also need to educate ourselves, I think, on what a National Cancer Institute, a National Designated Cancer Institute, that nearly all of our regions have that available. And if we don't have one of the designated cancer institutes, we've certainly got some sort of cancer institute in the area that's a reasonable proximity that we can take advantage of as dermatologists. We can integrate into that system in much better ways than we have previously in order to get our patients the best care.
So we have a lot of clinical quality measures that have been implemented that surround melanoma care. What are the national guidelines of this care, and how do we make sure that we're meeting them?
If you look at the NCCN, the National Comprehensive Cancer Network guidelines, they're about, 50 pages long. So I can't tell you all of the content of that in this discussion. But what I can say is that it's online. You can get the copy of these. You can look at these. And what's really helpful is they're built into algorithms so that you can find basically any patient that you have, you can find where they fit on the algorithm, and you can see what is recommended. And the thing that's nice about these NCCN guidelines is that they are, to the best of our ability, evidence-based. And where there is no evidence, they state clearly that there is no evidence. And they are guidelines. They're not mandates, right? They're guidelines. So there's room for flexibility in how you interpret them. But because they're all very well delineated and cited and reviewed regularly every year, you know that you're getting a really good, concise recommendation of how state-of-the-art care is being delivered elsewhere.
So a really helpful tool. I know one change that I've made is instructing my patients to do monthly lymph node exams. And I don't remember being trained necessarily to tell my patients to do that at home, and how that has become a sort of a standard to inform your patients to be doing self lymph node exams.
Yes, that's right. And I think there would be a lot of dermatologists that would also be surprised to read that it is considered standard of care to be referring your patients to a surgeon for sentinel lymph node biopsy. So there's been a lot of debate in the derm field about what a sentinel lymph node brings and doesn't bring. The message I want to get across is that it doesn't matter what you think about that. You're going to be held accountable to some extent for following these guidelines that are being established as sort of the gold standard of care practices. And so if you aren't going to follow that guideline, then you need to be prepared at the very least to document very clearly in your note why in this particular case this is not considered to be the standard of care for this patient, or you might find yourself in a little bit of trouble down the line if something goes wrong.
So what are some prevention strategies that are being developed right now for melanoma?
There's two new pathology-based sort of assays that I think are going to help us along the way too. One is an assay that is determining from the quantitative RT-PCR, it's determining whether or not the mole has a greater or lesser potential to metastasize. So it's giving you the prognostic value at the very beginning with a little bit better validity than just saying it's thin or it's thick. That's the idea behind it.
So you can take early melanoma that you've detected and determine how prognostically this patient's going to do those. That's
the idea. So, I mean, I'm not saying that this, you know, it's not completely ready for prime time yet, right? But the idea would be that by utilizing this technology, you might be able to identify lesions either better than a sentinel node or in addition to a sentinel node. And that would let you give more prognostic information about, is this a person who you do want to refer for an adjuvant trial? Or is it a person that is so unlikely that anything's ever going to spread that probably just an excision would do? And you might not even need a sentinel node biopsy. So that's the kind of thing that particular technology can offer.
Really tweaking that care to the individual lesion.
Right. So this is personalized medicine coming to fruition. Absolutely. And then there's another one that's coming out that's a quantitative RT-PCR assay that's looking, again, at moles and just having an examination of those from the perspective of, is this really a melanoma or is this a mole? And as we all know, especially we see dermatopathology reports, it's very difficult. There's this category of mole that it's very difficult to determine. Is it really just a mole and it's benign or is it a melanoma? And so whereas the other one was looking at early melanomas and telling you about prognosis, this one is looking at, do you really want to make the call of a melanoma, or is this one that you don't need to make a call of a melanoma? And again, this one is also still not quite prime time. It's just in the evolving stages. It needs longitudinal follow-up to determine validity and all of that stuff. But I think that this is the kind of thing that is going to really enhance our ability to know what to do with that individual patient.
And identify those melanocytic proliferations that we're not quite certain how to treat clinically. I know that some of those reports, I think we treat them mostly like early melanomas, but how nice to know how reassured we could be or not.
Right, exactly. So a lot of technology that's developing. And then there's also all kinds of new combination immunotherapy and targeted therapies or multiple targeted therapies. And those are in the process of being evaluated. And they're moving these things now into the adjuvant realm, as I mentioned, which I think is incredibly important and exciting because we know that the earlier you can treat these diseases, the better. And then finally, there's some population-based things that are going on. So what do I mean by that? I mean, there's screening programs that are going to be started that in Pittsburgh and in the western Pennsylvania by John Kirkwood that are going to start to look at what is the cost-benefit analysis, basically, of doing screening for anybody.
Do you mean skin cancer
screening? Skin cancer screening. And so what are the costs and the benefits? Can you really reduce melanoma rates like we saw in the Schleswig-Holstein experiment in Germany or not? So it's a recapitulation of that in an American way that will hopefully be able to say whether that's going to work for the U.S. or not.
And to have some standards or guidelines of doing skin examinations mm-hmm. and having that be part of our recommended screening. What are you seeing as some of the challenges to preventing melanoma with people's behavior or sun exposure? What do you see as sort of our biggest challenge in this realm of prevention?
Well, we've actually done a little bit of research on that because we were trying to figure out why people who are at high risk for melanoma, we're talking about P16 mutation carriers that have known for many years that their family, they get melanoma after melanoma after melanoma. They know they're at risk. We've given them the information that they need to be preventative, but they don't comply with those recommendations. And so we started reporting genetic test results as a way of trying to see if that personalization of the message would be able to have more impact. And in fact, it appears we're very early on. We've had some pilot studies that have been positive in that way, even out to 2 years, which is pretty exciting. But what we really want to know is it the counseling part of that? Is it the actual test result? What is the cognitive process that's going on in the mind of that person that takes them from the point where they know the, because it's not that they don't know the facts, but what takes them from knowing reporting the facts to implementing a behavioral change. And that is a really tricky question. It looks like it may have something to do with whether they think they can beat the odds by doing these behaviors or not. But that's the closest we can really get at this point to saying anything. It's still in progress, but we hope to have an answer for that soon that we can apply to all.
That's always been a question for me. What patients should we be sending for genetic testing? And do we need to find a specific genetic counselor that has experience with melanoma? Or when you're not in an academic setting, how do we get the patients to the right place?
Right. I think it is a really tricky thing in private practice. I don't think if I were in private practice, I would not be able to offer it in my office unless I had a dedicated person to do that, which I might want to do. I might decide that that's something I do want to do is have a genetic counselor in the office. But without that, I don't think as a practicing dermatologist, I would be able to do it. That's a great place for the NCI designated cancer center to come into play because they nearly all have cancer genetics specialists and genetic counseling services. A lot of them, melanoma is just transitioning into that clinical, real clinical utility. And so a lot of even the genetic counselors at some of those centers are not that aware of melanoma genetic testing, but they're becoming more aware. And so I guess I would recommend that right now, you follow sort of a rule of threes for referral. So the rule of threes that I follow is if you have three melanomas in a single family bloodline of any degree relationship, if there's three of them, they're invasive melanomas, not just melanoma in situ. If you've got three invasive melanomas, that's one criteria. Another rule of three criteria is if you've got two melanomas and a pancreatic cancer or two pancreatic cancers and a melanoma that or more, obviously more would qualify. But and then the third is a single individual that has three or more melanomas. And so if you fit that criteria, then it's appropriate to refer them to that counseling center. Now, if it's the first time you've ever referred them, it probably would not be a bad idea to also let them know that if they were not familiar with melanoma genetic testing, that you would be willing to provide them with someone who does so that they can feel comfortable with that.
I think that's helpful. I know in my community, we've been able to identify two genetic counselors that have a lot of experience with melanoma genetics, and that has been very helpful for me to identify in a non-academic setting where to send my patients to when this has come up. So tell me what you think of the quality measures and how do we put them into our practice to make us better dermatologists?
So what I'm always looking for is a way to apply those requirements in a way that really is meaningful to me, that makes sense, that I know that by doing that, I'm actually giving the patient a higher quality. So I think about it that way, and I would encourage everybody because it is kind of like a carrot and a stick, right? You have the opportunity to utilize this for the benefit of your patient, to enhance your practice, to make it the best that it can be with respect to the care of those people. And if you don't do that, the stick is coming because you won't get paid as much and you won't have the protection of following the guidelines and all of those things. So I think it's kind of a carrot and stick approach. And I think it's the same with all the whole field of melanoma. That, you know, melanoma is at one of the most exciting times that we've ever seen. And we have the opportunity as a specialty to jump in, join that excitement, be at the table, and really help to push that effort forward faster. And if we don't, then the stick is we're going to get left behind, and really the care of these patients is going to be drawn more and more into under the control of other people besides us. So there really is, I mean, you can see it as an opportunity or a threat, but I think seeing it as an opportunity in my perspective gives me a lot more energy to apply to that effort. So that's the way I'm going to look at it.
Right. I think we can't ever lose sight that we need to be at this table with melanoma, that we are trained to detect this in a way that no other specialty is able to do, and to make sure that they understand the value that we provide to our patients by screening for melanomas and taking care of these patients.
Incredibly well said. You want to introduce my symposium next year?
Well, I just want to thank you, Sansi, for being here. It's been a pleasure, and I'm thankful that you are part of our dermatology team in fighting melanoma. I think we're very fortunate to have you in our specialty, so thank you.
Well, thank you. This has been really fun. I really appreciate the opportunity.
Historically, the 10-year survival for patients with metastatic melanoma has been less than 10%. Until recent years, the treatment of malignant melanoma had primarily consisted of cytotoxic chemotherapies that were often used in the treatment of other types of cancers as well. Dacarbazine remained the gold standard for the treatment of metastatic melanoma for over 30 years from when it was first approved by the FDA in 1975. However, the advent of new targeted and immunologic therapies such as CTLA-4 inhibitors, BRAF inhibitors, and anti-PD-1 antibodies have demonstrated increased efficacy in treatment response and potential long-term survival outcomes of patients with melanoma. The interdisciplinary approach to the care of a patient with melanoma may involve the interaction of oncologists, surgeons, dermatopathologists, radiologists, and geneticists. As the field of melanoma research evolves, so should the role that dermatologists play in the management of patients with melanoma, apart from traditional roles of screening and diagnosis. This approach involves serving as gatekeepers for patients. The melanoma gatekeeper dermatologist must be knowledgeable about staging and the most recent evidence-based treatment guidelines for each stage. This information is available as an online resource by the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, or NCCN, with very streamlined algorithms. Appropriate patients should also be integrated into a nearby nationally designated cancer institute in order to provide them with the best care. Dermatologists also play an integral role in longitudinal follow-up of patients with melanoma in order to monitor for recurrence. Recent NCCN guidelines now recommend instructing patients to perform regular self-skin and lymph node examinations for stage 1A through 5 melanomas. Advanced stage melanoma patients that require referral to cancer institutes usually will likely have access to cancer genetic specialists and genetic counselors at those facilities. However, Dr. Leachman recommends the rule of threes criteria when determining whether to refer a patient for melanoma genetic testing. Having any of the following family history in a single bloodline with any degree relationship warrants referral. 1. Invasive melanomas in 3 relatives. 2. 2 invasive melanomas and 1 pancreatic cancer. 3. 1 invasive melanoma and 2 pancreatic cancers. 4. A single individual with 3 or more invasive melanomas. Current research also suggests that the process of referring for genetic testing can serve as a behavioral modification to increase a patient's compliance with photoprotection and skin cancer screenings. In summary, appropriate care of melanoma patients always starts with thorough skin screenings and definitive diagnosis. Subsequently, knowledge about treatment guidelines, patient integration into a national cancer institute, long-term follow-up, routine lymph node exams, possible referral for genetic testing, and patient education throughout their entire experience are highly essential for coordinating optimal patient care.